Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, this is me. Yeah, I'm back again. It's Fran Lewis, and I have to tell you, I am really glad that the last visitor to New York City has taken leave and she's gone forever. That would be Hurricane Sandra, Sandy. We really don't welcome you, and we don't really want you to ever come back. And we want to thank you for sending your Uncle Morris yesterday, because we had a snowstorm, people, and we just didn't want that either. But we're doing okay, and the sun is going to shine tomorrow, and it's going to be just beautiful this weekend. And we have a show that is really, really, really fantastic. I am so lucky. Straight from England, we have best-selling author of one of my favorite books for this month that I've read, Power Play. Patrick Robinson is here, and I want to welcome him. Hi, Patrick, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Fran. It's a privilege to be speaking to you.
Oh, thank you, and I'm just so excited that you're here. Patrick's book is Power Play, and it's just one of a whole bunch of books that he's written. And this book, Power Play, is the fourth book in his Mac Beckford series that includes, and I'm going to name them all, Diamond Head, Intercept, and Delta Solution. And he comes from Ireland, but he's calling us from England. Yay. And I have family there, a whole bunch of family in England, actually. And that I just found out about. Yeah, a whole bunch of family that finally contacted me. But we're going to talk about Power Play. How did you come to create the story of Power Play? But this is dealing with Navy SEALs, right? So for
yes,
those people
I'm usually involved with the Navy SEALs.
Okay, so how did you decide to create the storyline for this
Well,
one?
I can't, it all came because I thought that sometime in the next 24 months, Israel was undoubtedly going to hit Iran's nuclear center. That's not a particularly original thought, but I decided that I would find out all about it, how they were going to do it, and if possible, when they were going to do it. And having fiddled around with that for a month, I began to wonder who would be the angriest if they did. What would be the consequences of a Israeli strike against Iran's nuclear capability? And a bit more investigation showed me that the people who would be most angry would be the Russian government, because one of the biggest things in this world that they sell is their S-300 missile defense system, which is wildly expensive and averagely good. But the American equipment, bombers, deflectors, Israeli pilots, would go straight through it like a knife through butter. And so, having recreated the Israeli strike, I then sat about pondering what the Russians would say and how angry would they be. And the answer to that is very, very angry indeed, because this missile strike system that they sell to so many countries, including kind of North Korea and China, is so expensive, it is such an earner for them, that for the Americans to humiliate them would be taken as just that, as a humiliation, that the Israelis came in and just went straight through it and got rid of that nuclear facility in Natanz. And the Israelis are obviously training to do it. They are operating with laser beams over Crete, which is the exact correct distance between Tel Aviv and Natanz in Iran. That's the same as Crete, the island. And of course, doing a strike like that, your second duty, is to make sure you can get home. Like you, they can get very short of gas.
Thanks, I know.
And getting home from Iran in a fighter bomber, it has to be very carefully worked out, and you can only really work it out by trying these F-15 jets up over Crete, let them spin around the island a few times, because the bombing of those of the nuclear facility, when it happens, they have to blast a huge crater and then hit the bombs into the crater over and over and over again until the mountain splits. And meanwhile, the Russians would be very, very angry and would plan a reprisal. Now, big wars, when you knock down towns and kill people, are very, very old-fashioned. It doesn't really happen anymore, not with big powers. You know, nobody's going to take out a city and kill 300,000 people. That's as old-fashioned as the cavalry and swords. These days, they do strikes, targeted strikes. That's what SEALs are. When they wanted to get rid of Bin Laden, they didn't bomb the whole town. They just blew up his, charged in and got his house. But they didn't kind of do what people used to do, which is bomb everywhere. And what would the Russians do, I wondered? What they would do is a targeted strike. They'd hit something, and I picked up my target. And how they would do it? Well, I know they don't have a bomb. They don't have a missile that'll go far enough, fast enough, to hit that without being knocked out of the sky by the United States. So they need a new missile. But there are such things. So I worked out how they got their missile, where they would take their missile, and where they would launch their strike from. And, of course, it would leak. You can't keep something like that secret for very long. And if it leaked, it would leak through the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service. They're everywhere. And that way, America would find out. And the issue is, how does that strike target of Russia against the United States, how would they deal with it? Well, I can tell you how they deal with it. They deal with it with the SEALs. And the SEALs would be tasked with stopping that attack. And that's really what this book is about. But that's how I kind of worked it out. And you may have noticed about 10 days ago, there's a factory in Khartoum in the south of Sudan which is making a lot of the metallic hardware for Iran, including shells and rockets and missile casings and stuff that doesn't take a huge amount of brain work, but it has to be done. It's being made in the Sudan and sold to Iran. And I don't know if you noticed, but Israel took it out last Saturday night, week before Saturday. They just came in from the northeast, and they swooped over this factory and just took it off the map. And there's only 6 craters left where once there was a factory. And the Sudanese have complained bitterly that 4 people died. And an Israel commander mentioned to the Mossad that they were very lucky 400 people didn't die.
Because the Israelis...
The Israelis rather take the view that if Iran thinks it wants to go to war with them, let them try, and they will cope with fighting Iran if they have to. But what they won't cope with is letting Iran have an atom bomb. They're not going to do that. Which is why they're going to stop them.
I thought that was pretty good. I thought that was pretty good. Jack, you know, I'm partial to Israel, so you have to know that it really is very good. I have family there too. What can I tell you? As a matter of fact, I have a cousin who's a knight in the British Parliament.
Oh, really?
I would love to.
You're very international, Fran. I'll say that.
We're very dysfunctional here too. We're very international, very different here. We have multinational.
You might not be able to get any gas, but you're right out there internationally.
This is very true. We cannot get gas in New York State, people. So, you know, if the trucks are out there and they're listening, we need all the help we can get because the gas stations were dark today. They were closed. And we're not sure if they really don't have gas or if they just don't want to give it out. What can I tell you? And, the guy that delivered the pizza before waited 3 hours online, and he paid $6 for 1 gallon of super.
Oh, my God.
Because the guy was price gouging, so it's not right. But one of the characters that I really loved at the beginning of the book was Rene Bayadin. He's Israeli and he works for the Mossad. And he works with my other favorite character, Nikolai Chekhov. So how did he come to trust the Russian and how did they meet and why does he trust him? Because I really think those two are really great together. That's all I'll say about that. I'm going to give away no more.
Well, they always test things, Fran. When... Nikolai is an idealist, and like many people in Russia, they think that the government's propensity to upset people for no reason at all is absolutely crazy. intelligent idealists in Russia cannot understand why the government wishes to cozy up to the Ayatollahs and to, you know, want to be a friend of Iran, a kind of a rogue state. I mean, wouldn't it be much easier to be friends with the United States of America and get rich? And there are many people in Russia who think that the way they handle business is kind of stupid. You know, they have vast oil and gas reserves in West Siberia and a brand new pipeline taking it up to their new oil port in Murmansk on the White Sea, just around the corner from the White Sea, actually. And, you know, America are pretty big customers, especially some natural gas from up there and some oil, and they want to upset them. And that just seems crazy. And a lot of Russians think they are crazy. But that's the Russian way. Everything they can do, they do against the West, and they always have, and they don't appear to be able to get out of that mindset. Well, since Gorbachev, they haven't been able to get out of that mindset. And they're now very rich. They've got all this oil, and they're building one or two quite good warships, certainly a submarine, a very quiet submarine called the Kilo class, and they're selling that to China. They're just making a lot of money all over the place. And the Russian Navy is growing and growing. 30 years ago, they could hardly afford to pay the lights in the dockyard. Now they're building big ships again. They're building destroyers. They've got those big Typhoon submarines with the ballistic missiles. They're leaving port, many of them, for the first time for several years. We have a wealthy Russia with a navy that's absolutely on the move. And there are idealists in Russia who think that that is unnecessary and crazy, and they should think much more about trade. And young Nikolai was from a family that believed that. And he did not think it was any kind of an idea, having found out about it, that Russia was planning a strike against the United States, even if it was just to take out one important building. He just thought it was absolute nonsense and walked into the Israeli embassy, which is a known go-between for the United States, in Moscow, and told them that he was a Russian naval officer who knew a lot about a lot of things and wanted to help. And tell them what was happening. And so the Israelis did what you would expect them to do, is put them in touch with a Mossad agent who would deal with him for 6 months, take his information, check it, see how much of it was true, generally run him like a spy master. Well, he was a spy master. And that's what they do, and that's how it happens. And after about 6 months or a year, you begin to know whether he's telling you the truth. And when they checked his stories over and over, he was telling the truth. And in that way, they understood that Russia was planning this strike. And in that way, they were ready to tip off the Americans that there was big trouble ahead. That's how it happens.
I know, I read it. I did. You know, I started to say before, because before I can interview somebody, I have to read the book. I'm very fussy about that. And lately,
it's very good, because a lot of people don't.
I know. And lately I've been getting that, do you want to interview the author? And I go, I'm not interviewing somebody unless I read their work and look them up and get to know them. And they go, why? Because it helps to do the interview if you know what you're talking about and if you know the person's work. As a matter of fact, I get emails, will you endorse me? And I go, like, I don't know who you are. That's not going to happen. If I don't know who the person is or their work, I mean, and I can't look you up and I can't find a website, and you just say to me, could you look at this picture and tell everybody it's wonderful? No, I can't do that. Sorry, it doesn't work like that way. But this started with a fishing trawler that was sunk. And then it went into a huge international incident, right? And then it snowballed into what the Russians had in store for the United States. But it was really picked up by the harbor master, right?
He really wondered what was going on. You see, the Russians, we are not really any longer used to them prowling around in submarines. And they haven't done that for many years, really because they haven't been able to afford to. You know, it's an expensive game with submarines, and they haven't ever done it, but just now it's beginning to change. It's the first time they've really built submarines for a while, and they're getting the old ones refitted and refurbished. And America, well, United States Navy, has this ongoing problem with their SOSUS system, which is, you know, sound surveillance. And that was the vast electronic kind of checkerboard they placed on the ocean floor inside the Guyot Gap. And that is where they have always caught Russian submarines. They don't know exactly where they are when they come through it, but they know the square they're in. That's about 10 miles by 10 miles. And they know they're inside that square. Well, when they had the Royal Navy up to snuff, doing its stuff, they always had a couple of aircraft to go out there. There were four SOSUS stations in the British Isles, one in North Cornwall, one on the coast of Wales in Pembroke, one in Northern Ireland, and one in Macrahanish in Scotland. There probably were others, but if there were, I don't know about them. And they were able to keep a very good watch on the SOSUS wires, and if the SOSUS wires went off and they found a Russian ship coming through, mostly a submarine, they would be onto that very quickly. There may be a North American, there may be a United States Navy submarine patrolling, but they would send somebody in. They would not let a Russian ballistic missile ship, or even a Russian nuclear missile ship, they would not let that be coming down the Atlantic without wanting to know all about it. And over the last 30, 35 years, there are rumors that America, aided by the Royal Navy, has put a couple of them on the bottom of the North Atlantic for coming down there. Normally, the Russians would let people know what they're doing, which is why when they misjudged it and put one on the beach in Scotland, Everyone thought, my God, what's that doing there?
Well, the name of the ship was thickened. Yeah, it did. It certainly did thicken, because the name of the ship is the Gebhard, and it was sent there. And they claim the Russians tried to play that it was an accident, or they really didn't mean to be there. But six people died. Six fishermen died because of them. And that wasn't,
yeah,
you know,
they did.
They did. They didn't
they
seem
did.
To really have,
and know. That business about a fisherman being dragged under by submarines, that is not a flight of fancy. That has happened.
That does happen, right?
Yeah, it's pretty damn dangerous. I mean, up in that area where there are submarines, it's where the American base used to be, Holy Loch, where the Polaris submarines were. I mean, up there on the Clyde estuary, I mean, there were accidents like that. And there's supposed to be a man on the back of every fishing boat with a huge axe. And, you know, the slightest thing that something may be caught in the net and dragging them, they sever the net, lose the net and the fish and everything else. But at least they're not dragged under. And, you know, that is a hazard of the trade. But this one, my God, that was very bad luck. It was kind of 1,000-to-1 chance. The submarine went straight into the net and pulled it down stern first.
I often wonder why people even bother to do the kind of jobs. It's really so dangerous. But the Royal Navy is usually
there. Oh, they are dangerous. They're terribly dangerous. They're not so dangerous, Fran, if you're sharp. If you're sitting on the end of that stern, you think, my God, there's something going on. You've got your axe in your hand. You're ready. You know, that's not a problem. And the Navy will always pay generous recompense to a trawler man who's lost his catch and his net. They, you know, they'll always do that. But if you're not paying attention, that is not good.
I know. In other words, you're not supposed to be drinking coffee. You better be awake.
You better be wide awake when you're going through those waters. I wrote a book once for a man called Sandy Woodward, who was an admiral, commanded the Royal Navy in the Falklands War. Mm. In the South Atlantic, 1982. And he was a very amusing man and a good yachtsman. And he was coming up the Clyde estuary to take this big submarine back. And he said, I said we'd better go to the surface because we're not sure what fishing boats are about and see what we're doing. And he said, I came up right in the middle of the Clyde Regatta. He said, I was in the middle of about 25 yachts, all sailing up the Clyde. I was right bang in the middle of them. And I said, my God, what did you do? He said, well, I didn't hit one. He said, as a matter of fact, I tacked to starboard and finished fourth.
This explains why I don't do boats and why I don't do ships. I'd rather walk. I'm not too fond of planes.
So doing a book like Power Play is a great adventure.
It is. It was a great adventure. And you know what? I was really lucky, like I said, because your publicist emailed me out of absolutely nowhere. And he said,
oh,
we have this author. I didn't know who he was, and I knew who you were. But he said, would you like to read Patrick Robinson's Power Play? We would love you to interview him. And I go, oh, okay. I never know who's going to send me an email anymore. I just go with the flow at this point.
Oh, I didn't know it. Did that just come out of the blue?
Yeah. He must have found me, and I'm trying to figure out. There are a lot of publishing companies who send me books, tons of them. And I never know who's going to send me one. And PR by the Book is one, and Media Muscle is another one. And I don't remember. He works with Jane Westham, and I had just interviewed Margaret McLean. So he's from the same publishing company, publicist, as Margaret McLean, who is the president of the Mystery Writers of America. So obviously Anthony must have gotten my name maybe from her, from the publicist from that one. But I didn't care. It didn't matter. And I read what the book was about, and it's definitely my kind of book. And I was just glad that it wasn't one of those self-help books again, which I've been getting. Some of them are really good. Some of them are really I don't even need to read some of them. But I love mystery thrillers. I love spy thrillers. And I definitely love stuff about the Russians and Israelis and stuff like that. So, yeah, he asked me to read it. But Thirsty said, do you want to interview him? I said, you have to send me the book so I can read it. And then he sent me Ecoliterate with it, which is about the ecology and coal mining and stuff like that. I learned a lot, though.
Oh, yeah.
I love reading anything that I can learn about. There's only one genre that I won't read, and it's erotica. And I did turn down a book yesterday in that, and I said, that's the one I won't read. And that was the end of that email. I felt
you don't
bad,
want to get involved. There's nothing quite as tiresome as other people's sex lives.
Yeah, I really didn't want to read it. As a matter of fact, if I get something that's very graphic and the plot is good, I'll just skip over the rest of it. I don't need to read it. I once said to somebody, I could live it. I don't need to read it.
Doing your reviewing job, you have to be pretty selective.
I am very selective. And also, everybody knows, and I'll say it again, I don't get paid, people, to do reviews, despite what Amazon thinks. I don't know why they think that, but that's their problem. I don't write bad reviews. I won't write negative reviews. If I get a book that I really don't like, I'll summarize it for the author, or I just won't read it. And usually I'll tell the author, I can't give this more than 3 stars. It's up to you if you want me to rate it. Otherwise, I'll just give you a summary to use for publicity. And I have my own review site on. I won't write negative things about people because, you know what, I may give something 3 stars. Somebody may give it 10. They may think it's wonderful.
Did you read my Navy SEAL book that I wrote about 5 years ago?
No, this is the first one that they sent me. No.
This is a different publisher at the time. But I wrote the book called Lone Survivor. That was Marcus Luttrell, the Navy SEAL. A story of his battle in the Afghan mountains.
I've just got one called AOP123, which is similar, which is also a nonfiction one that the author wrote.
Now, this book, this Marcus Luttrell book, came out in 2007, and it stayed at number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 8.5 months.
I started reviewing books in 2000, at the end of 2009.
You probably would have spoken to Marcus, who was the SEAL. He was the only survivor. It was the day 19 Navy SEALs were killed on that mountain.
That would be interesting.
He was the only one who got away with it. And the big paperback edition was still on the New York Times 2 months ago at number 12 after 4.5 years.
Well, then you're going to have to send it to me with large print.
Yeah.
I find I read paperbacks, but when the print is too small, my eyes bug out, and then it takes me longer. I can read 400 pages in an hour and then review the book, but if the print is small, it's going to take me forever.
Yeah, you don't want that. No, this is the same as it's the big paperback. It's the same as the hardback typeface and everything, except it's got a soft cover.
Well, then you can send it. That's different.
It was 5 years ago now, but
well,
it hung around for a long time. Sold 1.5 million copies, you know.
Well, I'll just add it to my pile. No, I asked an author to send me.
And I'll tell you what would make it very topical for you.
Okay.
They started to make the movie last week.
That's even better.
A big movie. Mark Wahlberg taking the part of Marcus.
Mark Wahlberg? You're kidding.
$50 million budget. What?
Really? I'm Mark Wahlberg from Facebook. Wow.
Yeah, he's doing the. He's taking the part of Marcus. There are two or three very. The chap who had the lead in The Hunger Games is one of the SEALs.
Mm.
There, and there's Eric Banner. He's in it. It's big. It's $50 million budget.
Well, then you're going to have to send me the book so I can promote
it
on my
site. I haven't got
it.
The publishers are the people who have it.
Who
That's
publishes
Little Brown.
It? You know what? I have an in it, Little Brown. And I know
you
exactly
have?
Who to actually, well, what happened was I just finished reading David Baldacci's book, The Forgotten. That's part of Hatchet and Grand Central Publishing and stuff, and Little Brown, yeah. And they sent me that. That was fantastic. His new book is really good, people. You want to read it. And they sent me a few others that I've read. Panther by Nelson DeBell is also. I just finished reading that from them. Also, it's excellent. So the only author that hasn't answered me is James Patterson. What can I say? He doesn't.
Oh,
his
yeah.
publicist doesn't. I will email my friend at Little Brown at Grand Central and see if I can get it. I just
you
won't
want,
be
it's,
able
it's
to.
It's called Lone Survivor.
Lone Survivor. And you wrote it, right?
It's by Marcus Luttrell with Patrick Robinson. That's me. I wrote the book.
I am going to email my friend at that publishing company after I get off the air later.
I mean, it's really fierce stuff. I mean, they were up there with just 4 Navy SEALs. And they got into a tremendous battle with 150 Taliban warriors. And 2 hours later, after the battle down the mountain, 3 of them were dead. And 2 of them died in Marcus's arms. One of them was his best friend. It was terrible.
Well, I'm going to email him and tell him that you said he should send it to me.
Yeah, you should. Lone Survivor. He was number one for 8.5 months. You don't often get that.
Well, that's if they have copies of it, because it's been out for a
while. Yeah, they do. They're always reprinting it, Fran.
And I'm going to... I'm doing it, yes, because... My friend did, yeah, okay. And
yeah, I mean, and he was a major man, the Navy SEAL. And I based my new character, the character I use at the moment, Mac Bedford, is based on Marcus.
I was going to ask that next. Yeah, I like Mac Bedford. He's interesting. He's interesting.
He's a very tough man. Have you ever met a Navy SEAL?
No, but I've read so many books about Navy SEALs. I read Stephen Featherman, The Finish. Also about killing. It was about the killing of Osama bin Laden. It was that story, that particular one.
Oh yeah, that was yes.
Yeah. Not Mark Owen, but they sent me that, and I read a whole bunch of them. I've read a whole bunch of books with Navy SEALs. Yeah. But this one, I love reading about Navy SEALs, and I read Tom Clancy, but not really.
He can't write, can he? I mean, his writing's so dull.
Well, actually, I reviewed 2 of his books, and he wrote them with 2 other people, and the ones that he wrote with the other people were more interesting than the ones that he wrote by himself.
I'm perfectly certain they were.
1,000 yeah. pages is a bit much. 800
oh,
pages
I mean,
is a lot.
That's like reading the Bible.
The Bible was more interesting, to tell you the truth. I just reviewed one of my picks for this monthly, Harmon's, John's Gospel, and I learned a lot, and it was really good. I learned a lot, and it was really interesting, to be very honest. When a book is over 600 pages, you better be able to hold my interest. And there better be more than just repeating the plot over and over again. And I find that as a reviewer, that's what happens. They review the plot,
yeah,
and they keep writing the same thing over and over again. And by that time, I need a nap, or my eyes are bugging out. And if it takes me more than an hour, hour and a half to read between 400 and 600 pages, you know that there's something wrong. Because I can review the book and do the whole thing in less than 2 hours and do it right and give a detailed review.
How long does it take you to read a book?
It depends. Your book I read in like an hour and a half. Seriously.
How did you do that?
I'm a speed reader, but I read every word.
took about 12 hours.
No, my mom believed when I was growing up that I should read at least maybe 6 to 8 books every week. And take notes while I was reading them, which I did.
That's big.
And yeah, she was tough. And if I got it,
Fran, that's a huge talent.
Well, she was my huge mentor, my mother. Yeah, and then I learned how to speed read because I figured I had to keep up with her and her requirements.
Yeah, you bet.
I'm
writing the book now. I'm doing the book now. I'm just finishing it. Of those Navy SEALs who were court-martialed after they'd caught the most dangerous man in the Middle East.
Oh, whoa. And what's the title of it that I'm going to read next?
You can't. It's not out yet, and I haven't got a proper title.
When you come up with it, and you want me to write something lovely,
yeah, it's gonna be by
on the
me.
Back, or in, I will be more than happy to promote it, do whatever. And I even do back covers, so that would be fun, too.
Do you remember... That excitement when they were court-martialed, and the petition from Congress went to the Navy telling them to drop the court-martials, and they wouldn't.
Yeah, that was kind of ridiculous. I mean,
that was quite ridiculous. Well, I'm doing that. I've just been talking to one of them just now. I'll be finished in about the next 4 weeks.
But you don't have a title. You know, that would be really great, because if I could read it, review it, and get you on with the Navy SEALs, that probably would be even more interesting. Probably get a whole bunch of more listeners, too.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure when we'll get it, when it's going to be published. It hasn't even gone to the publisher yet. I haven't offered it to anyone. I wanted to finish it first.
Who are you going to offer it to?
But it's
going to
be a good it's going to be a good book. It's,
well,
I was thinking
it,
of calling it.
What are you going to call it?
I don't know. I was thinking of calling it, putting the seal trident on the jacket, and then the word over it, guilty, and underneath, until proven innocent.
That's an interesting title.
Because that's what happened to them. They were stripped of everything 7 months before their own court-martial. And my second title, I would probably will call it The Untold Story of the Most Notorious Court-Martial in the history of the United States Navy.
Mm.
They were all found innocent.
This is so interesting. But tell everybody about the character in this book. I love Mac.
He's a major man. You haven't read any of my other books?
No, actually, I don't get to buy books. I don't get to choose when I read. I just get them, and they wind up, like yesterday, 6 of them wound up at my door. And this morning...
Well, that's very sensible.
this morning, this author sent me five.
My man, Mac Bedford, started off 3 books away in Iraq. They were going along the Euphrates on a regular patrol. And a group of obvious insurgents and terrorists opened fire on them with a real bunker buster of a missile that went through 2 tanks and incinerated the crew alive. And they couldn't put out the fire. And when the insurgents did what they always do, which is very quickly got rid of their weapons, put up their hands and surrendered, walking across the bridge. Mac Bedford, who was a SEAL commander, and it was his men that had died, opened fire on them and gunned down all 12. for which he was court-martialed and said, you know, they just killed 19 of my guys and we're supposed to be at war, and that's what I did. And he was forced to leave the services. And that was the first book. And then the Navy came back for him. Everyone had known that he should never have been thrown out for that after the court-martial, and they brought him back. And he is now a commander. And in this book, he commands a platoon in San Diego, and he has to get prepared to come to the new American base and lead his platoon and sink this Russian onslaught on America before it gets off the ground. That's what that book's about.
Okay,
that's
the
Mac. He comes to Maine.
I looked up a few terms so I'd understand them better while I was reading it. And part of this thing is they were trying to get the nuclear football and determine its importance to the U.S. security. So if they got that, we would be in big trouble. So can you explain that to everyone? Because I'm sure people don't know what that is.
Yeah, the nuclear football is the heavy-duty briefcase that accompanies the President of the United States everywhere he goes, in order that if there was a sudden diabolical threat against the United States, he has that piece of equipment which enables him essentially to press the button and say, attack our enemy, and to tell the armed services command. But it's in a briefcase, a leather-bound briefcase in a bag. And it's really advanced telephone, but it is the system that goes direct to the armed forces, and many, many codes and code words. And he couldn't just say, I want you to unleash whatever it takes to knock down Leningrad or St. Petersburg. The codes have to be punched in so they know it's him, and they know where he is, and they know what he's saying. And it has to be supported by another member of his group. It's a very, very high-tech piece of radio material that keeps the president in touch at all times as the commander-in-chief of the armed services. And it's always known because it's the one thing that can authorize a strike back against an enemy. It's always known as the nuclear football, or more commonly it's known as the football. And if ever you see the president going anywhere and you look behind him, there is always a Secret Serviceman carrying that black leather bag, inside which is the president's route to tell the armed forces to act and act now. And the Russians knew about this, and they intended to block it so that the president couldn't use it. And they worked out a way to do it. They didn't want to block the codes. They wanted to just make it not usable. They wanted to get a radio link into it that would render it hopeless, so it couldn't get its antennae up sufficiently high to work. And they had it with a radio beam. And it was very cunning of the Russians, because they knew that if they launched anything at America, it might only get about 400 or 500 miles, and the Americans would see it, and much more advanced, would take it out of the sky, and that would be the end of it. And to prevent that, they decided to shut down the nuclear football. They wouldn't be able to do it long, but they'd be able to do it for a few hours, which would render a strike back by the USA out of the question. It was very cunning and very deadly, and Mac Bedford and his boys had to put a stop to that.
Mac Bedford, but he needed the Israeli guy to help him too. He couldn't do it without him.
The Israeli.
He's without Rainey, and he's got to come back in the next one, because I really like him too. This is my personal opinion. That when he was
Ronnie.
I like Ronnie. I like Nikolai too. I like the three of them together. They really do work together very nicely. to get. I really like the fact that there was a Russian working with the Israelis and the United States. It just sort of like, okay, this is really cool.
there's a lot of Russians who are, you know, very sympathetic to the United States. I mean, you know, that's why the book the title Power Play was so good. It was everyone doing what they could.
Well, you should read my review. They said it was really good, and I sort of brought that into the ending Power Play in my own little interpretation of what I thought it meant.
I'll have to have a look at the review. Where is it? On Amazon?
It's on Amazon under some, well, that's a whole other thing. Like I said, Amazon thinks I get paid, but I'm very smart, so, you know, there are ways to get things there. It's on Shelfari, it's on Goodreads, and it's on Facebook, it's everywhere. It's on Booktown, it's on a whole bunch of different sites. But
What do you sign it, Fran?
I sign it something other than who I am.
Oh, right.
So they won't know. So they don't know it's me. but it's there. I'm pretty sure your publicist has the links. But if you tell me your website or your email or whatever, then I could email it to you to see what you think. But a lot of people have read what I wrote. It's on Cafe Libri. If anybody wants to post a review, it's a great site. CafeLibriLunch.com. It's on Dig. It's on Twitter. It's on StumbleUpon. I belong to all these things. I think the review's pretty good. It's great. And if you're on Facebook,
golly, what a drama, Fran. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, you know, if I'm going to do something, like I said, my mother said it's got to be the right way, and if it's wrong, forget it. She was the type that said that after I read the book, I had to write the summary, had to write the notes, and then if I got less than 100 on a test, I had to write the whole thing over. So,
oh, my golly, that's a very stern taskmaster.
She was tough, but you know what? That's okay, because if not for her, I probably wouldn't have been able to cope with everything else that I've gone through in the last year, which is
right. She could have been a Navy SEAL instructor.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, after 36 years of working with kids in the elementary schools in the Bronx, I was the reading and writing staff developer and the dean of discipline. I have to tell you that one of the teachers said that they offered me a job at Rikers as a prison guard. They said I was that tough, but I had a heart.
That's excellent.
Yeah,
I will tell Anthony to send you my email.
Okay, this way I can email you the review.
Yeah, I'll have him send it to you, because it's a rather special email that the Navy have let me use, and I don't really want to say it on the radio.
That's right.
Are we on the radio now?
Yes, we are. We're live. As a matter of fact, my friend at Little Brown emailed me, and he just said that he's sending my request for your book to the publicist that's supposed to have it. So we're going to work.
Golly, what an excitement! Things are moving fast.
Well, I emailed him just now, and I said to him, you know, could you please find out who can get me Lone Survivor? And I said, Patrick Robinson's on my radio show now. It would be really cool. And he gave me the person's name, so he CC'd her, and if she answers me, that would be even cooler. And this way I'll get a copy of the book, as soon as she gets it. And
you've got a good update, because that film did start last week.
Well, the worst that'll happen is I'll just have to buy it on Amazon and get it anyway.
Now, they'll be cooperative with that, because, you know, with the film starting, it, you know, gives the book a bit of a new life.
Yeah, well, let's hope that they do, because let's hope this guy knows that
something terrible happened on that film set.
Mm.
They obviously had to have, because they're right up on top of some mountains near Santa Fe. And they had to have a lot of dynamite hanging around. And somebody stole it.
Oh, God.
Somebody broke in and stole it. I mean, there was enough dynamite up there to blow up Santa Fe. And somebody stole it in a truck. And the police, as far as I know, are still looking for it.
Police are always looking for something. It'd just be nice if they would always find it.
Okay. No.
So,
do you have a lot of people on this program at one time, or just one at a time?
It depends. It depends.
Oh.
When it's someone of your, of, you know, that's a New York Times bestselling author or someone that writes a book that I really want to get into, then I usually have one author. There's going to be somebody on at 5 o'clock whose daughter was a New York, who wrote for Newsday. She died of lung cancer, Laura Taranzano. And the father, Frank Taranzano, is supposed to be on at 5 o'clock to talk about My Life with Cancer, which was a book that he wrote with someone else about his daughter, Laura, who won the Pulitzer Prize for her article on TWA 800, that flight. And she was a famous reporter, and she died of lung cancer. So this is Lung Cancer Month, everybody. And so we're going to dedicate to raising some funds. And also my aunt died in 2007 of lung cancer. And it was from secondhand smoke, which is what she died of, secondhand smoke. She didn't smoke, this girl. So, yeah. On December, I may as well announce, on December 6th, we're doing a special show dedicated to veterans because I'm going to interview Kenneth Eaton, who's a prisoner of war from the Korean War. And his book, Missing Text, it's going to be interesting. We're also going to do Heaven Shall Fall by Rebecca Coleman. And the book is about a young man that was in Afghanistan and came back with a post-traumatic stress syndrome. So that's going to be very, very interesting on December 6th, which is the day before Pearl Harbor Day on the 7th. So that should be really great. And on December 18th, we're going to have like 8 people on the show. We're going to have a New York Times bestselling mystery guest, I can't tell you who, and we're going to have some mystery writers. And we're just going to talk about what goes into writing a book with a series with one particular character that goes through the series, and just what goes into writing that mystery that makes people want to read your book above everybody else. And anyone that wants to join, it's a mystery writer. Just let me know. We've got David Workman. We've got CJ West. We've got Delaney Oaks, Karen Vaughn, John Betcher, and we've got our mystery guest. And I'm not going to tell anybody who it is because if I do, then that would spoil my fun. And we're doing another one.
That's a powerful lineup.
Yeah, it is a powerful lineup, and each one of them has written some really great books. They're all 5-star books. And February 7th, we have another New York Times bestselling author who sent me 5 books at once, and I read them all. And he's been on my show twice, and he's going to start it. He's going to answer the questions if it all works out in February. And February 14th, Sandra Brown. That's a big deal. That's like, oh, my God. So this is great. So we talked before the show about why you chose Ireland as part of this, and Ireland. Well, we're not going to tell everybody why because that would kill the end of this. But how did you decide? How does the government decide DEFCON, the alert system, and the colors? What does that mean? Because a lot of people don't understand, you know, red, orange, yellow, and what they mean. So how does that pertain to our security system? Because that was part of the book too. I don't want to give away anything.
Yeah, they work it out. They work it out by whether or not there appears to be any kind of a threat to world peace or our peace. And normally we're just on kind of average. We don't think anything much is going to happen. But in fact, if there was any chatter about Russia and that something might in fact happen, I mean, that we would go higher. DEFCON goes up a bit, but you know, it doesn't it's never really, I mean, the highest it's ever been was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that was pretty high. I think it was DEFCON 1 or something. And really, since Glasnost, you know, since Russia and the United States became friends, we haven't had much, you know, it's not anything you really talk about because there hasn't really been anybody who might seriously threaten the United States of America. So it's just a national a military alert in case something, you know, shocking happens. It wasn't, as you know, it wasn't a huge part of the book, but one, you'd kind of want to know a little bit about it. And I mean, if people do need it to be explained, DEFCON really stands for Defense Readiness Condition. It's your alert posture gauge, really, since it was first developed. It's been around since 1959. DEFCON 5 is normal. That means nothing's happening. DEFCON 4, that means double take. That means the intelligence of watching and security measures are being strengthened. Maybe around the White House in Washington. They did go to DEFCON 3, which is yellow signal, increased readiness for 9/11. And they also went for the Yom Kippur War in 73, and the first day of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's pretty high. DEFCON 3 is something major is happening. The second time of that crisis, they went to DEFCON 2. That's a red alert. That's on a fast pace. Next stop is nuclear war. There's never been a call for DEFCON 1. Nuclear war imminent. That's never happened. Maximum readiness. But in this year, in my year, they have gone immediately to DEFCON 4 when it was discovered that Russia was actually up to something and was going to do something. They've moved it up a couple of jolts. And really, that's what it is.
I'm trying.
Does that help?
Yes, it does, because a lot of people that are listening really don't understand the alerts or anything like that, and they don't understand. They people panic right away too. I mean, it's like with the gas crisis here. People are standing online for 17 hours because they think they're never going to see a gas pump again. So a lot of it is hyped up in the media, and a lot of it is hyped up because just people are just getting panic stricken and nervous. So that people understand that. If people understand it, then that would really help. So let me have one or two
questions.
Yeah, I
think people should understand it. Yeah, it's the military alert system.
Yeah. I have one or two more questions before my next guest comes on, I hope.
Okay.
Which country?
Fire them right at me, Fran.
I didn't get to ask half of mine. There's tons more in this paper. Which country is the most powerful, and which ones have the capability of carrying out what this power play, what this book was about?
Now, the most powerful by miles and miles is the United States of America. The
I hope so.
A United States Navy carrier battle group, which is the war cell that America lives in peace behind, that carrier battle group is sensational. I mean, it's a 100,000-ton Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, 84 fighter bombers embarked on the ship. It's huge, obviously. It's a size of the Empire State Building lying on its side. It is surrounded. You have a couple of outriders, nuclear submarines, that travel out in front of it. It would contain in the group a couple of very big guided missile destroyers, very powerful ships. It would be three or four frigates out on the horizon guarding the whole thing. There'd be a fleet oiler that always would be there to refuel. And this thing kind of moves wherever it wants to go. It may go into the Gulf. It may go around and look at the Indian Ocean. But it is of staggering power. A touch of a button could take Moscow off the map. I mean, this is a major bit of kit. There are all the other countries in the world put together could not come up with anything as powerful as a United States Navy carrier battle group. Nobody's got that kind of hardware to, get behind something like that. And the United States of America has 12 of them.
Well,
does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Okay, so if people want to go and buy your book because they're listening to this show, they can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the stuff, online.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble are real buddies of mine. They're big supporters. We had a very special order of thousands of books from Hunter News on the airports. They wanted a special edition printed just for them of this book.
Oh, that is great. Well, everybody that doesn't read it really should read it because it's really fantastic. And I was really lucky to get it. And when your next one comes out, but you're not sure when it is, you need to contact me so we can have another interview, and I'll make it happen no matter when. Don't worry about that.
And I'll get Anthony to tell you my email, and we'll stay in touch.
That would be really great. I would appreciate it. And
I spend half of my year, or 5 months of the year, at my house on Cape Cod.
Well, then you're not that far away from us in Upper New York.
No, I'm not that far away. I've got an American wife and 4 American children. I usually get over there in May.
Oh, that is so cool. That is so cool. Then maybe you can.
And the house missed the hurricane.
The hurricane was just so much fun, and we're very glad that Hurricane Sandy left, and we didn't need Uncle Morris yesterday in the snowstorm, and we truly hope that, you know, she stays where she is and never comes back.
I think that's a very good idea.
Yeah, and we don't need any more of her uncles and cousins. But I want to
thank you very
much.
Okay, friends, thanks for chatting to me and listening to me, and thank you for all you've done, and we'll be in touch soon.
Yes, thank you.
Okay,
Frank,
friends. Bye-bye.
And do we have Frank Terenzano online?
Yes, you do.
Hi, how are you?
How are you? Nice to speak with you.
Okay, it's nice to speak with you, too. I'm just so glad that you're here. Is Paul going to be able to do the show, too, or no?
I talked to him earlier, and he had some problems with getting a sitter, I guess, for his son. His wife was expected home, but he didn't think she'd be home on time, though, not of him to participate.
Yeah, he said something about scheduling. That's what he emailed me, but that's okay, because I am really excited to do this interview. And this is Lung Cancer Month. That's happened. November happens to be Lung Cancer Month. I have an aunt that passed away a few years ago, my aunt Tova Ross, from secondhand smoke.
Uh-huh.
So this is, she never smoked in her life, and my uncle did, and my nephew does, so it makes it kind of like, it brings it all home.
Sure.
Is there a special organization that you want people to know about before we start, so that if they want to donate or anything in memory of Laura or to lung cancer, is there some special organization?
Yeah, there are two organizations that I mentioned in the book, I believe. Three, actually. We started a scholarship in Lauren's name at Columbia. She was a graduate of Columbia also. She got a master's degree there, and she also taught there as an adjunct, part-time adjunct professor.
Right.
So we established a scholarship in her honor, in her memory, I should say, in 2007, the year she passed away. And it was a small scholarship that we started. They made exceptions in our case. Normally, I guess, they in order to start a scholarship, you have to have a specified amount, but they made an exception because Lauren worked there and also attended there. So over the last 4 years, the scholarship has grown. My wife and I, we try to continue to support it every year as best we can, and also her colleagues, former colleagues, and school friends that she, from school, constantly sending the donations in, and we've been fortunate enough to issue scholarships for the last 4 years. You know, nothing big. I mean, maybe $1,000 or $1,500 to some deserving journalism student there, but it's something. And hopefully the whole intent was to, long after we're gone, she was our only child, and long after we've left the so-called paradise that we live in, I guess, her name will remain in perpetuity.
Yeah, so. I just found it. It's on the inside up above the copyright. I have it.
Yes, it is.
And it's Lauren Elizabeth Terenzano Memorial Scholarship Fund at Columbia University School of Journalism. Right, and the other one, it says Jones Legacy Uniting Against Lung Cancer.
Lung Cancer
Alliance, and to fund scholarships through this particular Memorial Scholarship Fund at Columbia University. I have it, yes.
Okay,
so this was a really, really, I have read an awful lot of memoirs. And this memoir really was so far above the rest. It was really fantastic because not only did you include what you wanted to, you know, share with everyone about Lauren, but you actually shared her words with everyone. And the blogs are really fantastic to get to know her better, to get to understand where she's coming from, and to get to understand her life and how she dealt with this horrific disease. When you decided to write this memoir, how did you decide what you wanted to include?
I just wanted to write about my daughter, okay? She was a warm, loving, truly altruistic young lady. And she was always thinking of the other person, always putting herself last. Mm. Everybody else came first, and especially her mom and I. I mean, she was just incredible. I mean, she used to laughingly she used to refer to us whenever she introduced us. She introduced us as Mr. and Mrs. Helicopter. For 39 years, we hovered over her. All 39 years. When I say 39 years, all 39 years, we hovered over her, you know. And, again, she was our princess, you know, and she was a little girl. And I'm sure most parents do the exact same thing with their children, you know. But she was just an exceptional child and exceptional woman.
Well, I got that from reading the book. She was determined, and she loved to write. That was her thing.
The book's original title, when I started this, I started it in, Lauren had often told me when she first got into journalism, she said, Daddy, someday, she says, I'm going to get a Pulitzer Prize, you know, and I hope to write a book someday. Well, she accomplished the first in part. She shared a Pulitzer, with her friends at, her colleagues at Newsday for their coverage of the 1996 TWA Flight 800 disaster off of Long Island.
I read that article this morning. It was a really good article. I read. I did. I read it this morning. Yeah.
Oh, you did. And so, my intent was that I was going to, or try to anyway, with this book, fulfill that other wish of hers. You know. And I started it back in November, December of 2010, and not having any writing background or any experience. I mean, I'm just a high school grad. I have no training whatsoever. And I sat down and with my word processor, and I've got a mishmash of pages here, there, and everything, everywhere, and I really had no direction, so I got about 50 pages under my belt, and I just reached a point where I didn't know how the hell to put it all together. So one day I was watching, first, before I get that, I contacted the Writers Guild of America. I said maybe I could get someone that might be able to help me. What they call ghostwriting, I guess. Is that what they what they do? And when I spoke to the people there, they wanted, you know, their fees up front. And I can't blame them. I mean, they weren't going to take a chance on somebody. But they were, you know, it just was a little more than what I was capable of spending. So I was fortunate to come across a gentleman by the name of Paul Linato. I happened to see in a Boston radio station. He was promoting a book that he had co-written with a woman up in our area. And I saw it. I made note of his website and his email address, and I sent him an email and put all some information there. And he got back to me within 3 or 4 days, and really seemed excited about the project. And we worked out a deal, and he helped me put this thing together.
Well, he did a really good job to help you put just the thing together.
He really did. He really did. You know, and he took, you know, subsequent to Lauren's passing. I had put together a book list, which I still I have. I had many printed. It contains all of Lauren's columns in full, because we use excerpts from those columns in the book. But I have the entire set of the Life with Cancer series of columns that she wrote the last 6 months. There are about 26 columns. And my intent was at the time, again, to honor her memory, was to put this in booklet form, which we did. I got authorization to do so from Newsday, and I had a booklet printed with all of the columns, and we make the booklets available to hospitals, treatment centers, support groups, or individuals who are currently fighting their battle with the scourge of the disease. And most of the hospitals, but we had hospitals in New York, Sloan Kettering, the Mass General Hospital here in Boston, Long Island University Hospital in Long Island, Gildas Club. I wrote them, and they all accepted, you know, copies. And I sent a bunch of copies out to them, which I assume that they give to their patients who are undergoing treatment or whatever the case may be. But that was our intent. And I still, as I say, to this day, I'm still sending these booklets out. People hear of it, and they make requests, and I mail them out a copy. You know, as I say, they're free of charge, but just in honor of my daughter. So, and as a matter of fact,
that is great. There are so many cancer centers, even where I am, up in Westchester and in the Bronx. I know that Albert Einstein Hospital has, on the 11th floor, has an amazing cancer center that would probably appreciate that also.
You know, that'd be great. I'll tell you, because I had difficulty, to be quite honest with you. I wrote many hospitals, you know, and sometimes they're reluctant. I guess maybe the higher-ups they don't want to commit, or they don't want to, you know, I don't know what the reason is, but I got rejections, you know, and I also got some acceptances. But some of the bigger hospitals, as I said, Mass General accepted them, Sloan Kettering in New York accepted them, Gildas Club in New York, they're it was Gildas Club, that's right, yeah, the organization, that the support group. That, as a matter of fact, Lauren and her mother and I, we attended meetings at the Gildas Club when she was sick, you know, going through her fight with the disease. But
I would imagine the Cancer Centers of America would accept something.
Yeah,
like
you know,
that.
But I'll tell you, trying to get somebody to authorize them, you know, I don't know if it's because
I know
maybe
what you're saying, because I did one on Alzheimer's, and the University of San Diego did take them.
Uh-huh.
And they're very receptive to everything. Well, the Kessler Foundation was receptive because my sister died of traumatic brain injury, so they took my book for that. But Einstein, you might be able to. At Montefiore Hospital, you might. As a matter of fact, I have a contact at Montefiore Hospital
If you could send that to me in an email, geez, I appreciate that. You know,
I don't have your email, but I have Paul's email.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll give you my email for that matter. As a matter of fact, if you don't mind me giving your email over the air, my email over the air, if people would like to get a copy, just email me their name and address. Have them email me their name and address, and I'll gladly send one out to them.
Just give me the email. I'm going to take care of getting it out there because I have my own review set. I'll just put it on
there.
Oh,
all right. All right. It's the initial is my first initial F for Frank. I'll spell it out for you. It's FFTERRA. ZZAN as in Nancy @AOL.com.
@AOL.com. Okay.
FTerrazan@AOL.com.
I got it. And I'm not going to put it in the chat room box, but I will take care of it. And
all right, that's great.
I have a contact at Montefiore Hospital that works in the cancer center there. Development Center. And I could ask Tracy if she would accept that and, you know, about Warren and information and stuff and see what they could do. I've been dealing with all of this for so many years with Alzheimer's that this is a big deal. Like I said, my aunt died of lung cancer, and my other aunt, who actually did smoke, the same thing. So people need to realize that, you know, when they're walking in the street and they're smoking a cigarette, you're harming somebody else.
Someone else, exactly. You know, there's still an argument against that. You know, there are many people who still – to this day, do not believe that secondhand smoke causes any problems, you know?
Well, they must be naive or just selfish, or they just don't want to hear about it, because secondhand smoke is dangerous. And I was walking in the street yesterday, and the man was literally puffing as I was walking by, and I covered my face, and I looked at him, and I said, you know, you're rude. Because people don't need... I have a big mouth, bad. I will not... I mean, there's no reason for that. You're walking in a beautiful area. You're walking no matter where you are. When I see kids walking with cigarettes in their mouth, and I just look at them and I go, would you mind putting it that way? Because I don't need to smell that stuff. It's bad for you. I mean, you go into an elevator and people are smoking and they're not supposed to. And that's so wrong and so inconsiderate. And, yeah, it can hurt you, secondhand smoke. So, I mean, you don't want to walk around with a mask on your face all day long either.
That tells you something about the intelligence of the American public. I mean, the warnings are on the packages and still. So what does that tell you? I mean, is it America? I mean, is it just, I don't know, you know?
People don't think it's going to happen to them. I think that they're very naive and don't realize.
I smoked for 30 years, and I was a heavy smoker. The business I was in, it was just a lot of pressure. And I gave them up 20 years ago, but, you know, I myself was addicted back then, you know, but... my Lauren smoked somewhat in college, not very much. Off and on, she did maybe occasionally, but nothing of any major consequence. As a matter of fact, her doctors considered her a non-smoker. You know, so I don't know what the answer is. I often say she lived in New York. She was there when 9/11 happened. I mean, could it be that she ingested some of that crap in the air? I mean, who knows? You know.
A lot of the firefighters, a lot of the educators in my building, some of them husbands were firefighters and got really sick with emphysema and mesothelioma and asbestos and stuff like that. So you don't even know. I worked in a school for forever, and there was asbestos, and I wouldn't even go into the room. that I knew they had it because there was a hole in the wall. I said, I'm not going to get sick and get a lung problem because you guys didn't fix it. People don't realize it could be the simplest thing. You just don't know. But I thought that the coolest thing I read in the book was, as a child, Lauren wanted to write. She wrote stories when she was a little kid, right? And she had a school newspaper, right?
I thought that was
fun. So you got to tell everybody about that because she always, her favorite thing was writing. My favorite thing is writing too. I love writing.
No, I attribute her desire to writing and reading. It was my wife. My wife mm-hmm. spent more time with her growing up, reading to her. And I'm sorry, I start to
it's
get
okay.
emotional. And she really brought Lauren along. I mean, she made Lauren enjoy reading. She made, matter of fact, mm-hmm. we have a series. We have the entire series. I shouldn't say a series. We have the entire series of the Nancy Drew mysteries. Lauren
I love Nancy Drew. Yep. Uh-huh.
Lauren was passionate about Nancy Drew. And we have every book that the woman probably, as a matter of fact, later on in life when she worked for Newsday, she had the opportunity to interview, I can't think of her name. She interviewed the writer. Yes, one of the original Nancy Drew writers out in Cleveland. I think it was Cleveland, Ohio, if I'm not mistaken. And there was a big, I have it here. There was the newspaper did a nice feature on it, you know, and with pictures and so forth. And Lauren, all those years, really relished reading every mystery that Nancy Drew came out with. And here she was interviewing the woman who wrote most of those, you know, which was terrific. The woman was about in her 80s, I think, at the time that Lauren interviewed her, you know, for the story.
Yeah, Lauren was passionate about writing. I think she wanted to be a detective herself. She wanted to model herself after Nancy Drew. I got that feeling at times. But
you know,
I'm sorry.
She was such a caring kid, you know. She really was. And even the littlest animal in our neighborhood, I can remember stories where we had a neighborhood cat one night. It was on a Saturday evening, and a neighborhood cat had been able to somehow get a hold of a baby rabbit, a wild rabbit. And he really did a job on it. You know, he literally ripped almost the skin off its back. My daughter, it was about 6:30 or 7 o'clock on a Saturday evening, and she was completely devastated and that we had to get her to a vet. We had to do this. And we must have phoned, I don't know, 10 or 12 different vets to try to get someone to see if they were open. We finally found one that was open, and we brought it down. But unfortunately, the cat had done its damage, and he had to euthanize the rabbit. But that was the way she was. I mean, she had a life. One of the prime purposes I wrote this book was, sure, she was courageous for the last 7 or 8 months of her life, even her whole battle, I shouldn't say that, with regard to cancer when she was first diagnosed in 2004. But the thing I wanted to point out also is that Lauren was a really caring individual. I mean, she wrote primarily about societal problems, abuse to children, the elderly, the homeless, mentally ill. She wrote all about those types of things, really writing about the people who literally fell through the cracks in our society, you know, who did not get any coverage or did not get any exposure because they don't have the backing or whatever the case may be. But that was primarily what she did, and she really enjoyed doing that. She really enjoyed trying to help or make life better for anybody, any way that she could for anybody else, you know. That was one of the main reasons that I say that I wrote the book. I'll give one instance also. That I'd like to say. When Lauren was in 2004, as I said, she was diagnosed in August of 2004, and they tried the chemo and the radiation and to hopefully shrink the tumors that were involved, but they didn't seem to be doing its job, so they made a determination at Sloan that they were going to have to remove her right lung, which they did about 3 days before Christmas. That was in 2004. Well, she came through with the operation, you know, really remarkable, flying colors. She was just a very strong strong individual. Well, subsequent to the operation, they continued to give us some radiation as follow-up and chemo to make sure that they got everything. But as usual, they always say that they got every cell, but one little cell is all it takes, you know, to get away and back all over again somewhere else. Well, in 2005, Lauren, when she was at Columbia, she had made good friends. She had many, many friends, but she had made friends with a young woman by the name of Dina Fernandez, who came from Guatemala. Mm. And Dina used to come up and visit us. And likewise, Lauren on occasion would get down and visit her. And matter of fact, her parents, I believe, own one of the major newspapers in the country. So in 2005, Lauren had gone down, Dina had asked to go down, and this was in the fall of 2005. So Lauren flew down, and while she was there, It was shortly after that Hurricane Stan had hit the area. And there were all sorts of problems with the torrential rains that caused all sorts of mudslides, and there were villages that had been completely enveloped in this mud and killed, I don't know how many people, children and individuals who lived in these villages. Well, Lauren, being the true journalist that she was, we didn't find out about this until after she got back. But somehow she was able to get a hold of the United States Army Southern Command. They were down there, I guess, on a mission of mercy. And she convinced them. How the hell she did it, I have no idea. But she convinced them to allow her to fly with four very young, very brave U.S. Army soldiers aboard a Chinook helicopter. And she spent the next 15 hours riding with them. They were going up to all these villages and providing food supplies and water supplies for the many displaced residents of those villages. And she wrote about it when she came back. And we never knew a thing about it until she came back, and because she, again, was always worried about us. We used to worry about her, but she worried just as much about us, you know. So, but she was just a remarkable kid, you know. And
I can imagine if she was still here, she'd be doing stuff to help for Hurricane Sandy. She'd be right out there.
Absolutely.
She would be right out there. And they sent Hurricane Sandy, you know, here. You had it also. And they sent the blizzard yesterday. We really, it's been fun.
We're still blowing up here. It's the winds have been so damn strong all day today. You know, it's just incredible. You know, so.
Yeah, it's been bad. As a matter of fact, that's the only advantage about doing book reviews and radio shows from home. I don't have to go out.
You know,
but
the only thing I the
you
only
can't
I
get gas here.
We have gas too. The only thing, the only I think I have to say is that maybe Al Gore was right. You know, everybody nay-nays the guy, but maybe there is something to the global warming. You know, so.
Yeah, I think there's something seriously to the global warming, because this is like, this weather is definitely not New York weather. It's just so different that it's been. And it's called getting sick weather, too. I don't like wearing a jacket, and I'm constantly walking out like my dad used to, with a long-sleeve sweater but a short sleeve with a short jacket that's like, because I can't stand bulky things.
Uh-huh.
And my husband looks at me and goes, you know, when are you going to, you know, realize it's cold outside? I never mind. Don't worry about it. I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be totally fine. But whatever happened after TWA Flight 800 really changed her, that story really got to her. And she insisted, right, on being allowed to cover that, correct? That meant something to her. And that Pulitzer Prize article was fantastic. But what happened after that, she just sort of, like, changed her whole everything changed. She became more involved with her work than she did with anything else, right?
Yes, absolutely. And unfortunately, she was married to a wonderful guy, and unfortunately, they both had careers, and it had some effect on their relationship. I mean, they remained friends, but it was something that wasn't meant to be, I guess, or whatever. I don't know what the exact circumstances were, but she built up with that, especially with Flight 800. She did more stories on the survivors, people. I mean, I shouldn't say survivors, but the families of those that were lost in that plane crash. It was a horrible plane crash. I can remember one story that she did was about a young girl. I think she was 15 years old, and she was going off to France to 15 or 16 years old, I think, to study over there, what they call a student exchange program.
Mm-hmm.
And turned out this young girl was an only child also, and she was killed. And Lauren did a feature on the mother and father, one of the features that she did in one of the stories about them, the mother parents. And she also, the parents, I think they were in their mid 40s or thereabouts, late 40s, they decided to have another child in vitro. And they had another baby, and it was a baby girl. And Lauren went back and did a nice story on that also, you know, and it was just a wonderful story, you know. She built up a sense of with most of the people. I mean, they really trusted her. I mean, she wrote with dignity. She wrote with, you know, she didn't do anything to hurt anybody. I mean, just to bring to light what they were going through and things of that nature. So.
I remember because one of the things that you wrote in the book is that some of the reporters that went there to interview the survivors of, you know, the families of TWA 800 didn't quite have the same kind of compassion in order to get the stories that she did. So
yes,
I remember
exactly.
That specifically, right, that she was able to draw it out of them without
That's
making
right.
them feel as if she was prying into their lives or attacking
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
Right?
You know, I have, Fran, I have another story I just want to convey. You know, we...
Go ahead.
After she passed away, we were, well, I don't want to say fortunate, but her mom and I received two awards for Lauren posthumously. One was with an organization, one of the organizations that I listed in the book there, Jones Legacy, Uniting Against Lung Cancer. We were fortunate to go to New York in November of 2007. As a matter of fact, it was on the affair was held on the evening of our anniversary, November 8th, and we received the award, the Joni Award, for Lauren on that evening, and they presented the award to us, and she was just and the other one, as I wanted to mention, she also had gotten, we received another award in May of the following year. It was called the Advocate of the Year Award, the Suffolk Community Council of Long Island Advocate of the Year Award. And the thing that I wanted to point out about that, we went to the dinner, and they presented the award, and we met more people that came up to us who were running various homes for abused children or the homeless or whatever the case may be.
I wrote an article on that too. I remember that.
Oh, yes, you know, and they praised her. I mean, just for her ability to help them, and just by her writing, I mean, she was able to get government action for them or whatever they thought they might need. And she even one of the persons who ran it came over to us and said there would be nights where, on the cold winter nights, where Lauren would go out with them in their van and go under bridges or wherever in these parks where these homeless people were living and probably get them to go back to the shelters, you know, that type of thing. So, I mean, she really had a genuine...
She was unique, let me tell you. She did a lot of things that most people talk about doing but would never
right.
do.
That's right. You know?
Exactly. See, I did. I read this book quite a number of times.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it's in front of me. It's in front of
me
right
is.
Now.
Oh, yeah. You know, that picture, that picture
is
my favorite picture, and she is so beautiful.
She was gorgeous, and the pictures in the book, oh, my God. You know, it
yeah.
helped to get to know you. It helped to get to know Ginny. It helped
yeah.
to know, yeah, it helped to know her, get to know her better. And she had
yeah.
some really, she had one friend, though, that you have to tell us about, Monica.
Oh,
which
yeah.
is her closest friend. You see,
exactly. Well,
yeah,
you know, there are five girls, okay, and I think I mentioned in the book, I refer
yeah.
to them in the acknowledgments as her de facto siblings, and there's no question about it in my mind that they were all five of them, because the support that they gave her. You know, we live in Boston, and we used
mm-hmm.
to when she was diagnosed, we would be making treks back and forth to New York City, and my wife would stay in the apartment with her, and I would sometimes, but she had a small apartment initially, and I wound up sleeping on the couch, and unfortunately, I had a problem with snoring, so. Lots of times,
I remember that part.
just to give her a break, you know, I'd have to go to a hotel, and that became very expensive. And fortunately, we were able to, the newspaper was nice enough to provide an apartment for our use during the latter months of before she passed away, so we could be close by to her, you know. But those girls, when the times we weren't there, Ginny would usually be there during the week, and I'd swing down on the weekend and take her back, or we'd both go down for the week, and she would tell us, "Daddy and Mom, you've got to go home now." She would literally throw us out. You know? But she had her friends that were there. They would accompany her sometimes if need be to a chemo or a radiation treatments. I mean, it was just the wonderful support that she got. And when I used to always comment to them. Thank them, ever so thankful for them, and they would. The first thing they would say to me, Lauren would have done the exact same thing for us. They said, you know, there's no thanks necessary, you know, and that was just the way she was, you know. So.
Well, there are two special dates: that March 28th and May 15th, right? Which
yes.
is flying the special kite,
I fly
right?
this kite. Yeah. Well, you know what? I'll give you the story on that. When Lauren was younger, I worked crazy hours. Okay, I worked sometimes 6 days a week, long hours, 10-12 hour days. So most times I never had the occasion to sit down for dinner with my wife and baby. So I used to tell them to go ahead and you know, have supper, and when I get home, I'll eat, you know, and that was fine. But so anyway, most times on Sundays, I was a kite aficionado for many, many years. I still loved kites and as a young kid, and then as I even as I got to be a grown-up, I guess I still love flying kites. I just love flight, period. And so I used to go to the beach. I'd take her, especially if it was a Sunday morning, I'd go out to get the morning paper back then or get some donuts or whatever the case may be. And lots of times, Lauren and I would take a trip down to the beach, you know, and I'd bring the kites with me and we'd fly. I'd fly the kite, and she used to get so excited about the kite. Daddy, you know, I can remember her running along the beach there with a little pitter-patter on trying to get that kite airborne. And all I used to remember her saying was, "Daddy, make it go higher, make it go higher." That's all she used to say, you know. And the original title for the book was going to be Reaching for the Sky. You know, that's what it was. And for the longest, that's exactly what I started as. And then the publishers thought that it was too much of a generic term, you know, title to use. And there were many other books that were titled somewhat like that. So we decided to go with the Life with Cancer title. Because, you know, Lauren, one thing she often said that when she got sick, she said, "Daddy, I'm going to live my life." She said that, and my her friends, when she picked that title, she decided she was going to life, comma, with cancer. Cancer became secondary. Her life was more important. Living her life was more important, you know, and that was what she was trying to express with that title. And I'm glad that we did change it because. She picked that, basically, and I'm glad we did change the book to that title also, you know. So, but
the
anyway.
Blog, if anybody hasn't read the book, and there are some people listening in the chat room, the blog, if you haven't read the book, Lauren's words are in it, her blog is in the book, and you get to know her, and you get to know each step of the way, how she felt, what she was going through. Would you ever take just the blogs and her articles and put them in a book? I mean, I know you put them in pamphlets, and I just emailed somebody about that to find out if they'll accept them there. And, you know, you never know who's going to take them.
Right.
Doctor's offices might take them, too.
Yeah, exactly.
You just don't
exactly.
know. Would you put all of her blogs and all of her articles in a book?
I don't know about that. You know, most of those articles are owned, okay, by the newspaper. They gave me permission to put that booklet together, and it's a non-profit type thing. I'm not looking for any, as I said, the booklets that I offer are free of charge. You know.
No, I know what you're saying.
You know, so there are those type of ramifications there that probably would prevent me from doing something like that. I mean, I wrote this book. I'm hopeful that this book does well, my wife and I have committed whatever we make from this book, our share, because don't forget we've got a co-writer, and we work on an arrangement with him. But whatever our share of royalties, whatever if and when they do come down the pike, so to speak, those three organizations are going to be the benefactors of whatever we do get from this thing. So
I wonder if the newspaper would allow you to do that if you told them that it was you were donating things. You're donating money
That's a good question. I suppose it's something I could explore, you know, with them. But
that's what really made the book even more special is because we got to hear Lauren's words, and the fact that they gave you permission to print her words were really great. What about some of the stories that she wrote when she was younger? Do you have those also?
I had most of, you know, unfortunately, I've just been a convert within the last 2 years or so to the Mac system. I had
me too.
Okay, I had PC. I had a PC, and I had just about every column that my. As a matter of fact, I still have some old newspapers, Newsday newspapers that I have in the house here, of various stories that she did. Whether it was about there was about a story that she did about the when they did the undercover of the people with Alzheimer's, the homes that treat people with Alzheimer's.
The nursing homes, yeah, I know.
The nursing home,
that's
right.
My cause. That's what my mother had.
Yeah.
My mother died of Alzheimer's.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
That's a biggie.
Yeah. Right, that's a biggie. And they did an undercover story on that. And well, you probably get some of that in the book anyway. I think it mentions how they went about it, how Lauren, you know, went ahead to do that thing. But there were other stories that she did. Even about the courtrooms and the night courts and things like that. And I used to have, most of those things on my computer. And unfortunately, PCs do what they do best, which is crash, if you know what I mean. You know, and I lost a lot of them.
Paul sent me some. Paul sent me three of them or four of them. I have.
Oh, he
those.
Did. Yeah, he got those. He got those online, and there's still some available. You can get them if you do some Google search. You know, you can.
Yeah,
you
I
can
got
come
a whole bunch
there.
Of them.
They're
there. Yeah, and they're worth reading. They really are. They helped me understand her more. To read her words really made it even more special. But reading the article on TWA and the one about the 15-year-old girl in the group home, that was even.
Yes, that was something. That was something. You know that I tell you, this kid was just. I don't know
she
what else.
She was amazing, yeah. So she was amazing. I have just a couple more questions, and then we'll close up because I know this
you know,
is hard.
Can I just convey one other story?
You can convey anything you want.
All
this
right.
is your hour. You can say whatever you want.
Okay. We moved back in 2011. We moved to another house, you know, and we've been up at this other location in Tewksbury where Lauren was went to school, and we were there for about close to 30 years, and Lauren was in New York, and we had a big, it was a ranch-type house. It was big, and we had quite a few rooms, and we said, well, maybe we should look around to downsize, and I always wanted to be near the ocean, so we moved down to the South Shore. I came across a small house, and we did a lot of work on it, you know, and I have a mortgage on it, but it was ultimately going to be Lauren's anyway, you know, so anyway, she used to love to come home, and she said, Dad, we get a call, and she said, Dad, I'm coming home, I'm going to veg out this weekend, you know, that was a famous line, I'm coming home to veg out, so anyway, to make a long story short, when we moved, we had a move, obviously, but I mean, to get all of the other stuff, the dishes and the clothing and everything else, she came home, and she stayed up here for about a week and a half of a vacation, and she drove, I had a 4Runner, a Toyota 4Runner truck, and I rented a van, and we went for 7 days straight, her and I, driving down with loads of dishes and all that, everything that you accumulate over a lifetime, you know. And she worked her tail off, really, no question. And she was a little bit of a thing. I mean, she was about 5 feet three, 5 feet four, you know, 5'5" maybe at the most, and like maybe 130 pounds. But she was a wiry little kid, very strong. And when she left the day she decided to go back to New York, because she was pulling out of the driveway, you know, I said to her, I said, Lauren, you know something? I said, son, you're the best little son any father could have asked for. And she got the biggest kick out of that. She worked like a strong little boy. You know what I'm saying? Not that I'm trying to differentiate.
Yeah.
But, you know, excuse me. But that's the way she was. She just was always there when you needed her, always.
So. You know something, she'll always be there. And because of what you're doing, she'll always be there.
I hope so. I really hope so.
I know what you're saying. I lost my sister last year from traumatic brain injury, and she was kind of young, too. So in order to keep her memory alive, rather than, you know, walk around and say, oh, my God, that's why I wrote my children's books of our antics when we grew up in the Bronx. So I'm Bertha, she's Tilly, and I just finished my 10th book, and I finally found a title, Bertha and Tilly Sisters Forever. So you keep them alive through the writing.
Yeah. You know, while she was writing her series there, I have a whole bunch of letters and cards and that the newspaper gave us when she was writing her series of articles on life with cancer. They were publishing, obviously, every week, but they were also syndicating them to various newspapers in different parts of the country. And we had cards and letters that she was getting from well-wishers, California, Texas, Mexico, New Mexico, and even as far away as England and Scotland and the Middle East. She was getting cards. People were reading her story online, apparently, and they were following every week to week, you know, and it's just amazing how, you know, the people out there really appreciated what she was doing. I mean, because she didn't pull any punches. When she wrote those columns, boy, she said it exactly like it was, you know.
It's too bad that the newspaper doesn't reprint the blog.
I know.
As a special section, especially this month for lung cancer
month. I'm hoping. I'm working with them now. They've indicated. I've been after them. They're going to run a. I was told they're going to do this now. That in the health section, they're going to run a link to it on their online edition, and I believe they're going to do a small write up, you know, about it in the paper itself, and also pointing to the link for the online edition, you know, so.
They should print the reviews that we all do also. They should reprint our reviews. I mean, seriously. I mean,
you know,
I can't
force them to do anything. I mean, they were good people. Don't get me wrong. They were really good to them.
Yeah, but this is Lung Cancer Month, and for the whole month of November, it would really be, even if they did it every year, just to get money, just to make people aware that secondhand smoke and tobacco is so dangerous, and that if we can prevent one teenager, one person from picking up a package of cigarettes, if we can make it clearer to the, you know, tobacco industry that we understand that they have to make money, but maybe they shouldn't sell to people under 21. Maybe 18 is too young. And you know what? I walk in and I don't know if they even card these people half the time.
I know. You know, there's one article that she wrote, which is the one that she actually interviewed the guy, the sales marketing guy from the tobacco company.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember reading that.
That Philip particular. Morris, I think it was.
It was Camel Cigarettes. I forget which one.
Camel Cigarettes,
Yeah, it was Camel. And this guy, she didn't even let him know she was dying of cancer. And that was when she had gotten a death sentence that they gave her so many, you know, only a couple of months to live. And she interviewed him from her hospital bed, and she never let on to him that she was calling him from her hospital. She was just doing what she normally would do as a journalist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, she was just a remarkable kid. And
well, she probably lived a lot longer because she had the courage and she wasn't going to give up.
Exactly.
She wasn't going to let it beat her. That's the key secret. And if they ever figure out a cure for this, that would be so amazing.
I know.
But unfortunately, I often wonder if they ever will. And the doctors that work with her, they were good. They were caring, according to the book you said.
Right, very very caring. You know, there's one doctor, Dr. Flores. You know, and they really hit it off, the two of them, because he was an only child. He was her age, and here he is. He was head of thoracic surgery there at Sloan. And he just moved on to Santa Maria, I think. I think it's Santa. I can't remember what hospital. He's not at Sloan anymore, but he now heads up thoracic surgery at. I can't think of the name of the hospital. I'm sorry. Just my train of thought here. But they really hit it off, and they really became really close friends too, which is sometimes is highly unusual, you know, for doctor.
Oh,
patients.
The other one, St. Luke's Roosevelt.
No, this he left Sloan and now works at. Is it Santa Maria? I can't think of the name. Santa Maria? Is there a hospital in New York?
Not that I know of. There's
I know.
Montefiore. There's St. John's, Riverside, which I doubt that he would go there.
Yeah.
There's Albert Einstein. There's St. Vincent's.
It's on the tip of my tongue, and it's not one of those, but it's oh, jeez, I don't believe
it.
I wish Paul was on the line. I wish Paul was on the line. He would know it was, because when I called Dr. Flores, he was gracious enough to allow Paul to call him and interview him. You know, so
We were hoping that he would have been able to be on the show with the other doctor, but
it would be
interesting to interview somebody that actually deals with that every single day.
Oh, I know.
And hear what they have to say to teens.
Yeah,
I wonder if. How they would react. Did you ever go to a school to speak to teens or to speak to people?
Did you ever go
to schools to speak to, or church groups or synagogues?
No, I never
or
have. I'm really not a public speaker. I never have been. I mean, I was just I'm just a blue collar worker all my life.
You're doing fine here.
Well, you know, you make it very easy, friend. Very easy to talk to. You know,
thank
so.
You. It's funny. My dad was a dry cleaner, and I worked in his store.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah,
so
I did.
You used to talk with people over the counter there. I know what you mean, yeah. You know, so.
Yeah, my dad kept getting me in the back. I had to beg to work. My sister was in the front. But, yeah, I you know what? This is a hard interview for you, and, you know, I'm glad I'm making it easy, because I want everybody to know how important this is and how wonderful the book is. And the book is in front of me, Life with Cancer, and no one's getting to borrow it. I'm keeping it. I have read 800 books in the last 2 years, and the ones I give away are the ones that can't fit in my closet anymore. But certain ones like this, no one's getting, because I find that if I lend somebody a book, they don't return it ever.
Yeah,
and if I loan somebody this memoir, I would have to make them promise me, in writing and notarize that they were going to give it back. So they're not getting it. They're going to have to buy their own copy. And I was really glad. What happened was Paul emailed me. I don't know how he found me. I really don't. And he asked if I would like to read it and to interview you and to find out more about Lauren. And I was really glad. It's a hard topic for me. And I said, you know what, I'm going to do this because this is too important.
Yes.
And we were worried last...
I thank you.
I thank you also because this is so great. And I know that Ginny's going through her own thing.
Yes.
And we're praying for her too.
Thank you. We're on the list. We're hoping that, Kidney will be available. You know, she's been on the list for about almost three and a half years now. So hopefully someone will come along or we'll find the right match and we'll be okay. You know,
I hope so too. And if any doctors are listening or anybody out there, I really think you should give this top priority. Seriously.
And
this is great, and I want to thank you so very much. Is there anything that you want to add?
Not really. I think I've covered just about everything I should. She was just a remarkable kid, a remarkable lady, and as I said before, truly, truly altruistic. I mean, she just loved people and loved making life better or trying to make life better for anybody she came in contact with.
I appreciate that you did this, and I am really glad to tell everybody that I'm going to repost the review on my review site after I get off the air. I'm going to repost this review so that everybody can read it. I think everybody should read it. If there's anybody, I put the email in the chat room box. I am going to email some people because this is too important. In lung cancer, this is lung cancer month, the month of November.
Yes.
Last month was breast cancer. This is lung cancer month, and it's equally as important. And I don't think enough people out there know enough about it.
Or are you even aware that this is
lung cancer month? I looked it up and I'm saying secondhand smoke, dangerous. And they don't realize you're walking into a room. I mean, it's as much as going to a party and people are smoking and they don't realize it. It's equally as bad to drink, but you're not hurting anybody else if you're the one doing the drinking.
Exactly.
You're not doing anything.
One of the stats that really floored me was when Lauren was writing the column there. Because she did a hell of a lot of research. I mean, she treated this like it was just a major story that she was working on, you know, and she really went in depth. I mean, she left no stone unturned as far as getting facts and figures. And the thing that completely blew my mind was that more women die from lung cancer than breast, cervical, uterine cancer combined. I couldn't believe that. It just blew me away. You know, I could not believe that.
I think a lot of women, when they get aggravated, divorced, or smoke, they stress out. They stress out and smoke
or eat, which is not
a good thing. That's the one thing you don't want to do, is to become an emotional eater or an emotional smoker. It's the same thing as far as I'm concerned. So I want to thank you so much.
Thank you, Fran, for having me, really, and thanks for getting the word out for my daughter's book. I really appreciate it.
I am going to do more. I'm going to do whatever we can, and I really think that anybody out there that you should read Life with Cancer by Frank Terenzano and Paul Leonardo. And this is the story of Lauren Terenzano, and you can look up her articles, and it would be great. And I want to thank Marcia Cook and Virginia Grenier because the world of ink belongs to them. I'm going to send, Marcia just said to me, send her the review. She's going to put it out on the World of Ink, which is a huge network.
A lot
of people that listen and go on
her
site on Facebook. And thank you so much.
Oh, sure. I know the other one thing I just want to mention to you quickly, Fran. If you'd like a copy of that, if you'd like a copy yourself of that booklet so you can see the booklet that I'm talking about that contains all of the columns she wrote, I'd be glad to send one. Just email me your address and I'll take it from there.
I will. I have your email up here, and I'm going to do it when I close the show in a couple of minutes.
Right.
If there's anybody in the chat room that has a question, now would be the time to ask it. If anybody has a comment, please let me know. I want to thank Blog Talk Radio, but before I close, let me tell everybody. They're waiting for this. They wait for this every month. They're waiting for me to give my picks of the month of the books I like.
Okay,
so for those of you that haven't read Brad Taylor's Any of Me of Mine, you can't until January, but you're going to want to when it comes out. It's excellent. End Emotional Eating by Dr. Jenny Tate. I read that yesterday in one day. Absolutely fantastic. And you know what? It ties into emotional smoking, too. So if you read that, maybe you'll think twice before picking up a cigarette. Fair Game, Patricia Briggs. The Forgotten by David Baldacci. My pick of the week for this week of my book of the week, The War Zone by John Henry Brebier. And Fans Not Customers by the man that created TD Bank and Commerce Bank, Vernon Hill. And absolutely fantastic books. And my pick of the month is my book of the week for this week, Cleansed by Fire by Jim Callan. And you can read all about him on my website. And I want to thank everybody. And we will be back next Thursday with FBI agent Mark Boughton and the Sacrifice and Darren Frey, Blood Reapers. You want to read it. It's really good. It's about vampires, but it's got a great plot. On November 6th, Missing Tags by Kenneth Eaton. He's a prisoner of war from the Korean War. And Rebecca Coleman, Heaven Shall Fall. And that's about a young man that came back from Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress disorder. So we've got a whole bunch of shows, and December 18th is Mystery Tuesday. And no, I'm not going to tell you who the mystery author is. And on that note, I want everyone to have a great day. Thank you, Sandra. Thank you, Marcia. Thank you, everyone, and have a great night, and goodbye.